in addition to routinely and illegally removing artifacts from the occupied Palestinian territory for research, for display in Israeli museums, Israeli archaeologists have for decades participated in an unscientific and very explicitly political project of removing and destroying evidence of not only Palestinian, but Arab and Muslim history across historic Palestine.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Politics Theory Other. My name is Alex Doherty and my guest today is Maya Wind. Israeli universities have long enjoyed a reputation as liberal bastions of freedom and democracy, and they enjoy warm relationships with their counterparts in North America and Europe, including the University of Columbia, the site of one of the many Palestine encampments that have emerged across American university campuses, and which offers a joint degree program with the University of Tel Aviv. But as my guest Maya Wind explains in today's episode, contrary to the depiction of Israeli universities as centers of pluralism and free inquiry, these institutions are directly complicit in the project to dispossess Palestinians of their land and rights. In her new book, which was the topic of our conversation, Towers of Ivory and Steel, How Israeli Universities Deny Palestinian Freedom, Maya demonstrates how academic disciplines, degree programs, campus infrastructure, and research laboratories all service Israeli occupation and apartheid, while universities violate the rights of Palestinians to education, stifle critical scholarship, and violently repress student dissent. Maya is a scholar of Israeli expertise and militarism and a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Anthropology at the University of British Columbia. So Maya, you write in your book that settler colonial states are founded through foreign invasion with the objective of eliminating native inhabitants and establishing a settler nation on native land. Settlers seek to replace the natives and claim the territory as their own. Settler colonialism is therefore understood as a distinct form of colonial governance because it centres domination over land, which in effect becomes domination over life. To maintain their settler state and make the place their home, settlers must continually reassert their exclusive claim to the land, making the violent campaign to disappear the land's indigenous peoples into an ongoing process of invasion and dispossession rather than a single or historical event. From the start, Israeli academia has been entangled in this territorial project of replacement central to Israeli state building. Indeed, before even the founding of Israel, the Zionist movement founded three universities which were explicitly to serve the movement's territorial objectives in Palestine. Can you talk about that early history of the establishment of these universities that, as you described there, preceded the establishment of Israel in the 1948 war, and how from the very start they've been intimately involved in the project of demographic engineering in what was historic Palestine?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you, Alex, for having me. So the project that the early Zionist movement called openly colonization was replaced with a new term by the Israeli state after its establishment in 1948, with a new term, which is Judaization. And Judaization is quite simply the Israeli articulation of the twinned project of, at the same time, expelling Palestinians from their lands, shrinking Palestinian land ownership, interrupting Palestinian territorial contiguity, while at the same time expanding Jewish settlement and transferring in a unidirectional and permanent manner Palestinian lands to Jewish Israelis. And as you said, and as I write about in the book, Israeli universities have been absolutely central to this project from even before the founding of the Israeli state. So the Zionist movement founded its first three universities, Hebrew University in 1918, and then in the 1920s and 30s, the Weizmann Institute and the Technion, as state-building institutions. And the location of the very first university of the Zionist movement, Hebrew University, in Mount Scopus, was very intentional to stake symbolic and political material claim to the entire city of Jerusalem. And what we see with the universities established post-1948 is a continuation of that project where Israeli universities were established as land grab institutions. And in particular, in regions that were of demographic and territorial concern to the Israeli state. So in the Galilee, which is the only region within 48 within the Israeli state where there is still a Palestinian citizen majority living post the Nakba, Israel establishes the University of Haifa. In the Nakab, what Israel calls the Negev, which is the region to the south where few Jewish Israelis wanted to settle, Israel established Ben-Gurion University as a means to pull more Jewish Israelis from the central cities to the south to replace Palestinian Bedouins. And then, of course, we see with the occupation of the occupied Palestinian territory, in particular the West Bank, including East Jerusalem in 1967, universities continue to anchor land grabs there. So Hebrew University, Mount Scopus campus, further expands onto the lands of Isawiya and other neighboring Palestinian communities in occupied East Jerusalem. And the latest university to be accredited is Ariel University, located at the heart of the illegal settlement of Ariel in the heart of the occupied West Bank. And this university, too, was quite explicitly conceived of and planned for by the founders of the settlement of Ariel as a means to normalize and legitimize this settlement, this illegal settlement project in the heart of the occupied West Bank, and to bring more Jewish Israelis from Israel proper to the settlement. So what I show really in the book is that over a century, Israeli universities were planned and built as pillars of Israeli territorial and demographic engineering.
In the book, you emphasize that that process of colonization and ethnic cleansing that you describe within the so-called Green Line is not something that was completed in the late 40s, with ethnic cleansing and the creation of settlements subsequently being more confined to the occupied territories, but rather that that process of Judaization of Israel continues down to this day. Do you generally think that it's a mistake to try and draw too stark a distinction between Israel's activities in the occupied territories and within Israel proper?
Absolutely. This is a false distinction that Israel is trying to promote in international discourse that is totally contrary to its actual practice for well over 75 years. So Israel is trying to carve Palestine into Bantustans to govern them as separate. But really, there's only one project under Zionism, which is the project of Palestinian elimination and their replacement with Jewish Israelis. And that is true across historic Palestine. So both in the occupied Palestinian territory and in what is now Israel. And we see this perhaps most clearly in the region of the Galilee, which was a region that was particularly politicized and had a strong Palestinian politics after 48 as well. So what we see is in the wake of Land Day, which was in 1976, where Palestinian strikes and protests of Palestinian citizens protested Palestinian land expropriation by the State of Israel. And it really became a watershed event. And in response to this mass mobilization by Palestinians, the University of Haifa begins to collaborate with the Jewish Agency to strategically expand the Jewish population in the Galilee through a top secret program called Mitzpim, which is derived from the Hebrew verb to look out. And these were settlement projects, right? But within Israel proper. And they were very explicitly placed on the tops of hills overlooking Palestinian towns. And the idea was for these Mitzpim, these Jewish settlements, not only to interrupt Palestinian territorial contiguity and undermine Palestinian political mobilization, but also as a means to recruit Jewish Israeli residents living there to oversee Palestinian land use and to collaborate with the state to restrict Palestinian use of agricultural land and to interrupt the growth of Palestinian towns. And so this program was facilitated by planners, geographers, demographers from the University of Haifa, and over decades continued to be honed, assessed, and refined by these Israeli experts. So it is not only that the University of Haifa and other Israeli universities themselves physically served with their campuses as land grab institutions, but also that they continue to aid the Israeli state in this continual process of Palestinian dispossession. Again, as you said, both within 1948 borders and in the occupied Palestinian territory.
And when it comes specifically to the occupied territories, You write in the book that Israeli academic knowledge production developed through ties to the Israeli government and military in the occupied Palestinian territories was often itself steered toward direct military applications. Israeli universities designed and continue to run tailored academic programs to train soldiers and security forces to carry out their work and to enhance their operations. Can you talk about some of those programs, the personnel involved in delivering them, and how they have directly impacted and enhanced the ways in which the IDF manages the occupation and fights its wars?
Right. So I'll start by saying the Israeli Academy birthed the Israeli weapons and security industry as we know it today. So the Haganah, which was the leading militia of the Zionist movement and later became the foundations of the Israeli military, established a science corps that operated on the campuses of the Zionist movement's first three universities, Hebrew University, the Technion, and the Weizmann Institute. And in the lead up to the 1948 war, faculty and students themselves participated in the development and manufacturing of weapons to aid in Palestinian expulsion, including through the deployment of biological weaponry to poison their drinking water. And what we see in no small part due to lobbying by Israeli scientists in Israeli universities is that in the 1950s, they advocated for Israel to not only import weapons and technology, but actually to develop and produce its own. And so what happens is that in the 1950s, the Science Corps eventually becomes detached from the military and integrated and brought under the Ministry of Defense, and then becomes the Authority for the Development of Armaments, or in Hebrew, Rashut Leumit LePituach Emtzei Lechima. And this directorate is best known to many of us in the international community by its Hebrew acronym, Rafael. So Rafael is actually one of Israel's leading state-owned weapon corporations, a major supplier to the Israeli military. And it is not only that Rafael was birthed from the Israeli Academy, Israel Aerospace Industries, Elbit Systems, Israel's largest weapons producers and global exporters, were not only developed out of the Israeli Academy, but are continually sustained by it. And the Israeli campuses continue to serve as laboratories for these corporations to refine and to develop weapons and technologies used against occupied Palestinians and then exported abroad.
And part of the sales pitch, of course, for these weapons is that they are battle-proven in the occupied territories, right?
Yes. So these weapons and technologies are sold abroad as battle-proven. And Rafael still openly calls itself the National Laboratory of Israel, which is really true to its origins, the facilities of the Weizmann Institute and the Technion. And the Israeli campuses are central nodes in this national laboratory that Israeli weapons corporations themselves use this terminology.
Just going back to the foundations of the Israeli arms industry, is it right to say there was something of a split at the time, that parts of the establishment were perfectly happy to continue to import arms that had enabled Israel to win the 1948 war, particularly with shipments of Czech arms, whereas another sector saw the value of producing this domestic arms industry?
Yeah, so Israeli scientists, particularly based at Israeli universities, among other sites, were among the advocates for the development of Israel's own military industry. And leaders in Israel military industries today openly speak to the critical and pivotal role that the Israeli university system has played in the development of what is today now one of the world's leading military industries. Former chairman of Elbit Systems called the Technion Elbit's DNA, and they openly speak about Israeli university campuses serving as critical laboratories without which they could not have developed to the scale and to the global acclaim that they have today.
You have a chapter in the book on the various academic disciplines that are taught in Israeli universities and how they serve the Israeli government and the security state. Some of those disciplines have more obvious and overt political and military applications, but that's perhaps less the case with some others. For instance, you write in detail about archaeology departments at Israeli universities, and we don't tend to think of archaeology as being of much significance to the security states of most countries. But you describe the way in which archaeology departments in Israel have played a very major role in dispossessing the Palestinians and buttressing Zionist narratives about the history of historic Palestine. Can you expand on the role of those departments in the settler colonial project and the propagation of Zionist ideology?
Yes, absolutely. So just a few months ago, Israeli soldiers released footage from Gaza, where Israel surveyed and removed thousands of archaeological artifacts from the Palestinian Israel University before blowing it up. So now these artifacts have been removed from a Palestinian university and are now in the possession of the Israeli Antiquities Authority. And this looting, of course, is not only an egregious violation of international law and all accepted ethical standards of the discipline of archaeology, it is also not an aberration. This is actually squarely in the tradition of Israeli archaeological practice, including in the academy. So as I show in the book, all departments of archaeology across Israeli universities work very closely with the Israeli Antiquities Authority, the military government of the occupied Palestinian territory, and settler organizations to conduct excavations and research in archaeological sites in the occupied Palestinian territory. And this is not only an explicit violation of the Hague Convention, UNESCO's guidelines that strictly regulate the use of archaeological research by occupying powers, it is also part and parcel of the Zionist territorial and demographic program. So in addition to routinely and illegally removing artifacts from the occupied Palestinian territory for research, for display in Israeli museums, Israeli archaeologists have for decades participated in an unscientific and very explicitly political project of removing and destroying evidence of not only Palestinian, but Arab and Muslim history across historic Palestine. And anthropologist Nadia Bolhaj has shown in her research how Israeli archaeologists created what she calls an evidentiary terrain to substantiate Israeli claims to the entirety of Palestine through the assertion of an ancient and presumably uninterrupted Jewish presence in Palestine. And as I show in the book, archaeological digs, both in Palestinian-occupied East Jerusalem, including the neighborhood of Silwan, or occupied West Bank village of Susia, among other sites, archaeological digs and research are used not only to erase Palestinians from the historical record, but also to eliminate them in the present. And that is what is important here, because under the aegis of archaeological research, Palestinian lands are expropriated and Jewish settlements are expanded. And so structurally, the discipline of archaeology facilitates the erasure of Palestinian history in order to enable the Israeli state and Israeli settler organizations to continually appropriate and steal Palestinian artifacts and Palestinian lands.
One further point you make is that not only does Israel, as you describe there, seek to erase Palestinian, Arab, Christian, and Muslim history, but it also tries to appropriate to itself all Jewish heritage in the region, which perhaps has an interesting resonance with the way in which Zionism in general tries to appropriate Jewishness and attempt to speak for all Jews, including all Jews in the diaspora. Can you give an example or two of that aspect of Israeli archaeology pertaining to Jewish heritage?
Yeah, absolutely. So one particularly important example is the centerpiece, in fact, of the Israel National Museum, which are the Dead Sea Scrolls, that were actually seized from in 1967 from the Palestine Archaeological Museum in East Jerusalem. And these were artifacts that Israel appropriated because they are of Jewish heritage. But in fact, these were illegally looted from the occupied Palestinian territory and are now on display in the Israeli National Museum. And simply because they are of Jewish heritage does not give Israel the right to loot this artifact and to display it in its own museums or to conduct academic research using this looted property. And so you are right to point out that this is squarely in the Israeli tradition and the tradition of the Zionist project to appropriate Jewish history, and in this case, Jewish artifacts, as their own. But this is absolutely unacceptable and illegal.
Another of the academic disciplines you write about is Middle Eastern studies, including the teaching of Arabic. Can you talk about the very particular and unusual aspects of the way the discipline is taught in Israel and how it perhaps contrasts with Middle East studies departments elsewhere in the world?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, as you can imagine, the study of the Middle East has been a strategic, a national priority for the Israeli state from the outset. And this is an expertise that in Israel, tellingly, is termed Mizrachanut, which is Orientalism, literally translated. And it continues to be called this, right, to this day. And so, you know, really like archaeology, Israeli Middle East studies really developed at the intersection of Israeli academia, the military, and the state. Founders of this field were deeply entangled with the Israeli security state. They served as Arab affairs, what Israel calls Arab affairs advisors to the Israeli military and government. And one of them, even Menachem Milson, served as the very first head of the civil administration, right, which is the Israeli military government of the occupied Palestinian territory. This is an Israeli Middle East scholar at Hebrew University. And he himself oversaw the forced closure of the Palestinian University of Birvit beginning in 1981. And so this is sort of the history of this discipline. And to this day, and I write about this in the book, leading Middle East studies scholars serve in senior positions in the intelligence corps. They're securing data and funding from the security state for their research. And they are employed by the military, both as researchers and as instructors. And in particular, of note, is the Department of Islamic and Middle East Studies at Hebrew University that runs a flagship program to train Israeli soldiers. So all Israeli universities run programs called Atuda, which is academic reserve, to supply the Israeli military with a cadre of highly specialized and skilled soldiers amidst what is otherwise a draft of high school seniors. And the Department of Islamic and Middle East Studies at Hebrew University runs one of the most prestigious of these programs called Chavatzalot, which is a program where Israeli soldiers complete a BA in Middle East studies in another field to prepare very explicitly for service as officers in the intelligence corps. And this sort of military academic training includes not only linguistic and regional training of the Middle East, but also military training in intelligence capabilities and research methods, including data collection and processing, and then internships at the Israeli Military Intelligence Directorate, the police, the Shin Bet, the Mossad. And what this program does is then streamline Chavatzalot graduates into leading units of the intelligence corps, including Unit 8200, which is responsible for the vast network of surveillance over Palestinians that uses the most intimate information, information about sexual orientation, medical treatments needed by a loved one, financial difficulties, the most intimate of information. This is cultivated and then used by the Shin Bet and the military to extort Palestinians into serving as informants and collaborating with the Israeli military. And what is also really important to note is that Unit 8200 soldiers are actively serving in this genocide over the last 6 months. This unit has been charged, among other tasks, with creating a mass target bank to guide Israeli killing of Palestinians in Gaza. So it is not only that the Department of Middle East Studies at Hebrew University and that the Israeli Academy is sustaining Israeli settler colonialism, is sustaining apartheid for decades, but they are actively complicit in this genocide.
You also describe how some scholars from Middle East departments also play a role in the media war, and you discuss how they promote racialized tropes about jihad and what they call an Arab, quote, death worship culture. And one example you give is Uzi Rabi, current head of the Dayan Center and chair of the Department of Middle East and African History at Tel Aviv University, who's also become a major news pundit. Could you say something on him and his activities and how they are sort of emblematic of the media side of what some of these people get up to?
Yes, absolutely. So Mizrachanim, which is the Israeli term for, you know, Orientalists, right? Israeli Middle East experts, ostensibly, many of whom are based in the Israeli Academy, whose training is not only academic, but also military. They continue to serve not only in official capacity to the Israeli state by serving in the intelligence corps and other military and security state positions, but also many of them take on an additional informal role, which is in the war of Hasbara, what Israel calls state propaganda. And many of them serve as pundits on Israeli major news channels. So Rabi is one good example. He, as of 2022, has been a pundit on major Friday night news panel on Channel 13, where he really sort of betrays this deep entanglement of the Israeli Academy and the Israeli security state, because he routinely speaks in the first person when he's referring to military policy, and he offers advice to the Israeli military on how to best control and govern the occupied Palestinian territory through the military. And, you know, he is among many other Israeli Middle East experts who have openly called for absolutely illegal state practice, Israeli state practices against Palestinians in offensives on the Gaza Strip. So in 2018, for example, Rabi advocated that, I'm quoting here, that those who live in Gaza should know that if they confront Israel, Israel will strike a blow that will leave them with a mental and operative disability. Now, these are words that are uttered in 2018. So, of course, they have a particularly devastating resonance today. But we're seeing this as a long history of Israeli Middle East studies experts facilitating and legitimizing egregious forms of Israeli state violence against occupied Palestinians in Gaza and elsewhere.
Going back to what's actually taught in Middle Eastern departments and on the teaching of Arabic, you write about the way in which Arabic is taught as a language to be, quote, read rather than spoken, and that despite the presence of Palestinian citizens of Israel, it's taught very much as a foreign language. I mean, we might really say an alien or enemy language, given what you describe, and is overwhelmingly taught by Jewish Israelis, despite the fact that there are more than 2.1 million Palestinians living inside the Green Line. Why is Arabic taught in this way? And what do you see as the assumptions that underlie such a seemingly peculiar approach to language instruction?
Yeah, so here I follow scholars, both Palestinian and some Jewish Israelis who've written critically about this, about how the Arabic instruction in the Israeli Academy is so thoroughly militarized. So the instruction and the study of the Arabic language, I think, has to be located in the broader context of the colonial nature of the Israeli Academy, which is so thoroughly severed from the region within which it is embedded, which is the Middle East. And so by extension of the ways that the study of the Middle East as a whole is thoroughly militarized and dominated in the Israeli Academy by Jewish Israelis, many of whom have extensive military training that has informed and served in senior positions in the Israeli military and security state that has informed their study and their investment in the study of the Middle East, so too Arabic instruction is designed to serve the Israeli state needs. When I was in high school in Jerusalem studying Arabic, the intelligence corps visited our classroom to make it clear to us in no uncertain terms that, and this is what they said to us, that the Israeli state was giving us the gift of Arabic instruction and that we, in turn, were expected to give back to the state by serving in the intelligence corps and using this linguistic expertise that we were acquiring for the Israeli state. And so we see an extension of this from Israeli high school education into the academy. So the Israeli academy plays a very important role in the preservation of the study of the Arabic language as such a thoroughly militarized field. So rather than teaching Jewish Israelis, under 3% of whom today speak Arabic, this despite the fact that many Jewish Israelis originally came from countries where Arabic was the native language, and despite the fact that Arabic is the native language of Palestine, under 3% of Jewish Israelis speak Arabic today, and the Israeli Academy plays a very important role in training Israelis to study Arabic in order to study Palestinians and Arabs, but never to speak with them, to hone them, to hone their capacities to govern them and to colonize them, rather than to live alongside them in freedom and equality.
Another aspect of the book is the experience of Palestinian citizens of Israel who are students at Israeli universities. And you point out that the presence of those students is often used in promotional literature and other materials by those universities in order to propagate the idea that Israel is a successful multicultural society and that Palestinian students are welcomed and treated the same as everyone else. What is the actual experience of Palestinians in Israeli institutions, and how does it differ from that rather cynical portrayal?
Yeah, so it is so important to make a distinction. The presence of Palestinian citizens of Israel on Israeli university campuses is not the same as the presence of Palestine, right? So Palestinian identity and politics have never been and are still not today allowed on Israeli campuses. So to give the longer history of this, the very right of Palestinian citizens to an education and to higher education in particular has never been consensus in Israel. And so during the years where Palestinian citizens of the Israeli state were themselves under military rule, which is between 1948 when the state was founded and 1966, the Israeli government explicitly debated whether or not allowing Palestinians to enroll at their universities would aid in their assimilation and their acceptance of the Zionist project, or if in fact an education would further politicize them. And these were debates that were had in the Israeli government. And ultimately, one of the reasons that Palestinian citizens were allowed to enroll in Israeli universities was that some in the Israeli government believed that granting more Palestinians an education would actually aid in reducing their birth rate. And so this too, even the entry of Palestinian citizens to the Israeli Academy itself was another site of demographic engineering by the Israeli state. So we have to begin with this. And when Palestinians first began enrolling in Israeli universities, this was very explicitly conditioned on loyalty to the state, and they were very tightly surveilled by the Israeli university administration alongside and in close collaboration with the Israeli security state. And so these practices, even after the end of the military government in 1966, have incredibly long afterlives and continue to this day in different ways. And so it is actually important to know that Palestinians remain, and this is backed by data even from the Israeli state, not only by Palestinian and other researchers and civil society organizations, but even Israeli Ministry of Finance data itself has shown very clearly a real problem in Palestinian underrepresentation in Israeli campuses, not only as students, but as faculty and staff, and of course as administrators. And that in fact, not only is the gap between Palestinian and Jewish Israeli citizen participation in higher education, not only is this gap not shrinking, but this gap is in fact widening. So that is also important to state. But more importantly, I think, a focus on numbers and on the mere presence of Palestinian students in the way that the Israeli state is mobilizing it is very intentionally obfuscating the severe repression faced by Palestinian scholars and students when they enter the Israeli Academy. So critical research, writing, speaking, organizing by Palestinian faculty and students has been made untenable in the Israeli university system. And so it is not just about their presence, it is about how they are treated when they enter the Israeli university campus.
Would it be fair to say that just on the question of the presence or the absence of Palestinians in Israeli universities, that the direction of travel is towards greater exclusion with the increasing radicalization of Israeli politics to the right?
Well, again, I think it is really important to stress that the project of Palestinian elimination is constitutive of the Zionist project and the Israeli state. And so this has been a constant. And so this project of elimination is not only sustained by Israeli universities, but extends to their campuses. And so what we are seeing on Israeli campuses is different manifestations of the Israeli state's attempt to eliminate Palestinians, in part by eliminating their politics. And so, yes, in certain respects, the rise of the far right and the coalescing of university administrations and the capitulation of university administrations to demands by the Israeli far right to further curb and restrict and repress Palestinian speech and organizing on campuses has gotten worse and has particularly gotten egregious over the last 6 months, where we're seeing very severe and violent forms of repression of Palestinian students on Israeli campuses. But structurally, Palestine has never been allowed to enter the Israeli Academy. Palestinian politics, the Palestinian identity has never been allowed entry to the Israeli university campus. And Palestinian scholars of education, Palestinian researchers and writers based in the Israeli university system have been writing about this for decades. And I took great care to cite this very important scholarship in the book. And I encourage everyone to read this scholarship and engage with it, because I find that in the Western Academy, we don't read this scholarship. And we have been allowed for too long Jewish Israeli scholars to gatekeep and to narrate Israeli universities, despite very clear analysis and data and research conducted by Palestinian scholars, painting a very different picture of the Palestinian experience in the Israeli academy. But this has not been adequately engaged with in Western universities.
You've already touched upon the extraordinary difficulty that scholars at Israeli institutions experience, and the repression and hounding they face if they depart from Zionist shibboleths. More so for Palestinian scholars, but it also affects Jewish Israeli scholars too. But could you talk about the recent case of the Palestinian scholar Nadira Shalhoub Kevorkian, a feminist scholar at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, who was recently arrested on supposed suspicion of incitement to terrorism?
Yes, absolutely. So Nadira Shalhoub Kevorkian, as you said, she's a feminist scholar at Hebrew University. She's been teaching there for decades. She's based at the School of Social Work and the Faculty of Law and the Institute of Criminology. And Nadira researches and writes about the lives of families, women, and children under occupation, and the ways that the Israeli military, police, and settler violence shape the everyday lives of Palestinians. And Nadira, not only herself, lives through this violence every day in occupied East Jerusalem, where she is a resident, but she has conducted deep ethnographic research over decades. Ethnographic research is what we call, right, when researchers conduct observations, they embed themselves in the communities and situations that they wish to study. And she has also, over many years, conducted interviews with Palestinian children whose experiences are overwhelmingly invisible to the international community after decades of dehumanization of Palestinians in the West. And so as a feminist scholar, she is very intentional about making the invisible visible, and to expose how the Israeli state engages unarmed children as combatants in a practice that she calls unchilding. Of course, we have seen the devastating effects of unchilding over the last 6 months in Gaza, with over 13,000 children killed, including of starvation and thirst, and including thousands of Palestinian children orphaned. And Nadira also writes about how the Israeli state and weapons corporations use the occupied Palestinian territory as a testing ground to refine technologies and sell them abroad as battle-proven, as we've discussed. And for this courageous and uncompromising research, she has been discredited and harassed at Hebrew University by her students, by her colleagues, by the administration for many years now. And this really coalesced recently when the university suspended her last month for speaking publicly against the genocide and for speaking to the atrocities committed by Israeli soldiers and the Israeli state. And after her suspension by Hebrew University just last week on April 18th, the police raided Nadira's home. They confiscated her laptop and her phone, her latest academic work in progress, her books, many of which are still in the possession of the Israeli police. And they detained her overnight in harsh conditions. They shackled her hands and her feet. They denied her medication. And they threatened her and interrogated her about her academic scholarship. And, you know, according to Nadira's lawyers, this is really the first time in Israel's history that a professor has been arrested for published scholarship or for this kind of public speech. And this is, of course, a clearly illegal arrest. She's been accused of incitement to violence based on her critical scholarship for exposing Israeli state violence and genocide. So, in other words, her critical research exposing Israeli state genocidal violence is then being used to accuse her of incitement to violence. And this case is still ongoing. So it is critically important that everyone listening and everyone in the international community continue to follow her story, continue to put pressure on the Israeli state to stop her interrogation, because only keeping up international visibility and pressure will protect her. And I want to say a word more about this, which is Hebrew University is responsible for this campaign against Nadira, not only because for years they have refused to uphold her academic freedom, her right to conduct critical research about the Israeli state, but they have actively participated in her delegitimization as a scholar. That has fueled the harassment and intimidation campaigns against her, because a lot of the campaigns against her now, that is a very public campaign in Israel, centers on delegitimizing her scholarly work. So the Israeli media has been publishing hit pieces about her in the last week in particular, where they have accused her of fueling criticism against Israel. And because of international pressure, Hebrew University has called on the Israeli police to release her when she was arrested. But at the same time, the Hebrew University administration went on record in the Israeli media to continue to delegitimize her, and they said that they strongly condemn the conclusions and arguments of her research. And by the way, including in her articles that have been published in internationally renowned peer-reviewed journals. And the faculty of her own Institute of Criminology have come out against her, accusing her of, quote, I'm quoting them, blurring the lines between politics and scientific facts. And this is particularly ironic from the same institute that conducts research using classified data collected on Palestinians by the Israeli National Police and the Shin Bet, including through illegal interrogation methods and torture. So this data serves as a foundation of much of the university-based research conducted in this very same institute, resulting in policy recommendations for the Shin Bet and the Israeli police. So speaking of the blurring of politics and scientific fact, and maybe just one more thing to say about this, Simon Perry, who is a celebrated criminologist in Israel, in her Institute of Criminology, where Nadira teaches, he in particular spoke out against her in the Israeli media, and he accused her of falsely accusing the Israeli state of conducting experiments on Palestinians in East Jerusalem. And this, I think, is particularly curious because the leading criminologists in her same department promote their studies as useful to law enforcement, and they wrote and published articles where they claim to be offering the world best practices in counterterror policing. And they themselves have brought delegates to observe the checkpoints and comprehensive surveillance systems in occupied East Jerusalem. Simon Perry himself has written in one of his journal articles, and here I'm quoting, Israel has the potential to serve as a fascinating research laboratory for studying policing. So these same criminologists in her institute accusing her of lying when she is writing about the ways in which the Israeli state experiments on Palestinians under occupation in order to refine methods of policing and militarized modes of governing an occupied population that are then exported abroad alongside technologies. These same criminologists are part of the apparatus of producing this expertise and exporting it abroad. And as we spoke about earlier, Israeli weapons corporations themselves openly speak to this experimentation. So when Israeli scholars who work with the security state say it, and when Israeli weapons corporations say it, this is widely accepted as fact. When a Palestinian critical scholar is writing about it and critiquing it, she is accused of incitement.
Many Western universities have strong ties with their counterparts in Israel. And one example you give in the book that seems particularly pertinent just now is the University of Columbia in the United States. And you refer to the dual degree program they instituted together with Tel Aviv University in 2020. Can you talk about how Columbia and other Western universities characterize their Israeli counterparts and how they help to portray Israeli universities as bastions of pluralism and liberal democracy?
Yeah, I think this is such an important question. And I think that those of us who are based in the system of higher education in North America and Europe need to think very critically about why it is that our own university system has such deep ties to the Israeli university system, where no such parallel programming exists and no such parallel collaborations exist with Palestinian universities, or for that matter, with Arab institutions of higher education and others in the Middle East. This is a very stark contrast. And this is because Israeli universities are held up as exceptional in the broader landscape of the Middle East. As you said, as bastions of pluralism and democracy. And this Western consensus is particularly striking to me, given that for over two decades, Palestinian intellectuals and scholars and civil society organizations have contended that the Israeli Academy is a pillar of Israeli racial rule and Israel's system of oppression against Palestinians. So the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, PACBI, first issued its call to boycott the Israeli Academy back in 2004 on the basis of the deep complicity of Israeli universities with Israeli apartheid. And yet this Western consensus about Israeli universities, which has been promoted in no small part by many Jewish Israelis and the Israeli state, has remained insufficiently contested. And so in this book, I'm offering data so that the international community and the international academic community in particular can assess the data about Israeli universities for themselves.
You've touched on it there, but regarding the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, you talk in the book about the response of Israeli academics, or at least the vast majority of them, to the campaign and the mischaracterizations they indulge in, the way in which they describe boycott, divestment, and sanctions as a form of persecution and often, of course, anti-Semitic. Can you talk about some of the ways in which they've responded and how inaccurate those responses are, but also the fact that a central role is played by scholars who portray themselves very much as progressive and open-minded?
Yes, absolutely. So I want to begin by saying that there is a very intentional campaign by the Israeli state that many Jewish Israeli academics participate in to delegitimize and to misinform the international community about the academic boycott. The academic boycott issued by PACB in 2004 was accompanied by guidelines that make very clear that this is an institutional boycott aimed, like the campaign against the South African university system and historically white universities in South Africa, this campaign is aimed to hold Israeli universities accountable for their participation in and sustaining of Israeli apartheid and Palestinian unfreedom. And, you know, as abolitionists, we have to attend to the very important distinction between accountability and punishment. One of the most common misconceptions that I encounter about the BDS movement and the academic boycott is that this is a punitive movement. Nothing could be further from the truth. This is a liberatory movement that seeks accountability and that seeks to build international pressure on the Israeli academy to sever its ties from Israeli apartheid and to stop facilitating Palestinian unfreedom. And the fact that Israelis hear accountability and the Palestinian demand to live in equality and freedom alongside them as a threat is itself very telling. And I think this speaks to the zero-sum game that is the settler colonial state, where settlers can only understand their lives or the possibility of their lives as bound up with the death, with the elimination, with the unfreedom of others. And so it is a intentional misrepresentation by Israeli academics, including self-styled progressives in the Israeli academy, to portray the call for academic boycott and for accountability as punitive or as unjust, when in fact this is a movement for justice, for freedom, for all.
You've been listening to Politics Theory Other. If you've been enjoying PTO and finding it useful, please do consider rating or reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts. It really does help to bring in new listeners. The show's music and graphic design is produced by Planet B Productions. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week.